outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
I think it's about to get very noisy here, Kyle.
Do you have a large jackhammer or heavy equipment that's outside your window?
Yeah, not the jackhammer. That'd be a blessing today. No, this is a mega drill of some kind that's going under 40 foot of patio to cause
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's been a sad week here at Jacobson Acres. We found out all of our drains from the backyard to the front yard have collapsed under the weight of the clay soil that it sits in.
Oh my gosh.
They're 40-year-old pipes and they're very thin, so we're having to excavate a bit and get it under a 40-foot place to park an RV is quite a challenge. It was supposed to have happened last week, and like everything else in this house, it'll happen when it happens. So everybody left the property about Thursday about noon and said they'd be back, and what they meant was they'd be back on Wednesday, July 5th.
Okay. Yeah. Took a very nice long weekend.
Place has been a disaster. I see other construction people around the neighborhood when projects are going on. They worked on Saturday. They worked on Monday. They took the 4th off, which is, I thought the holiday was a one-day holiday, but not this year. It's a 5-day extravaganza for some people out here in California. That was all of the different crews doing different things out here. So, yeah, it was a pretty filthy weekend. And I mean, the house looked like a disaster yard because there were open trenches and a pipe, the old pipe, some of it had been pulled out and just strewn across the yard. I mean, it looked like I was in Mississippi after a tornado thing. That's what the yard looked like. It's horrible.
Maybe you should have done the 4th in Cancun or Cabo or something.
So now I've been waiting all morning to get the big drill out here. And I think now they're right outside my window getting ready to open the place to put the drill in there. So I don't know how loud it's going to get, but I am not stopping them. Drill away, guys. And we'll try and make a podcast out of it while it's going on, Hope. Did you have a good holiday?
Did. We to my family's cabin outside of the Laramie, Wyoming, up into the Snowies. And
all you do in the summer is you go to a cabin every weekend.
As much as I can.
And you don't give me any heads up, like I'm not going to be available on Monday or anything. You just leave town, oblivious.
You know, it is a wonderful, glorious thing to not have cell service. It's a nice unplug.
For you, maybe.
Yeah, that's true. That's fair. That's fair. No, we went up and my siblings and their kids and my parents, we went up and enjoyed some fishing and lots of games and laughter. And then my brother-in-law and I, we took some souped-up side-by-sides and went and did a over 100-mile, 6-hour off-roading adventure. And my daughter, Elle, went with me on it. And her only complaint was when Daddy went through the really, really deep mud puddles and threw a bunch of mud in her hair.
I do think I saw a video of that.
It is up on Facebook, yes.
Yes, I did see some video of you going through this. But you don't know when you go in a mud puddle, right? It could be like 40 feet deep.
Yeah. And a lot of these were active either stream or river crossings. There was times where, is there a boulder under the water that I'm going to get high centered on? What are we going to do here? And there was a couple of times where it was deep enough. Water was coming through the doors and I had to go fairly quickly so that we didn't suck any water up into the exhaust.
Oh my gosh. So you took what we talked about adventure last week seriously and we decided to go out and have an adventure with your daughter out in the woods. Did. With a side-by-side and somehow survived.
We did. And it was cool. A great time. My daughter hung in really well for a 3-year-old to be able to do 6 hours in a side-by-side with almost no complaint whatsoever was pretty impressive.
And then I heard you almost killed yourself with a tree.
Yeah, I was doing a little bit of pruning and a limb broke the wrong direction. Thankfully, I had cleared and my ladder took the brunt of it. I was very thankful that I was not on the ladder when a limb as thick around as I am, came swinging back into the ladder. That was a little spooky. So unfortunately, my really nice, tall, extending ladder is no more. But other than that, we're all good.
What's the diameter of this limb?
Oh, probably 18, 20 inches.
They're professionals for things like this. You know that?
They do.
Okay.
They do have professionals for those. I've done quite a bit of tree falling in my life. It's one of those things where you can never predict. You do the best you can, but if there's a a live core in a limb that you don't predict, or a knot or something that you hit, you never know where they're going to swing. So you just have to plan accordingly. And sometimes your equipment takes the brunt of it. Thankfully, it was all clear. Nobody got hurt.
Yeah, thankfully it was the equipment. I think I'm going to do up my God Journey podcast host possibilities list, updated.
Yeah, you should probably, given some of the adventures I've been on lately, you might want to start creating a list of alternates.
Yeah, no kidding. Hey, Wiz. Yeah, well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And this is The God Journey, episode 901.
901.
We've begun a new century, or new 100 mark or something. I don't know.
Okay. And then we're moving in on a millennium. That's pretty wild.
So what's the best thing you heard this week?
The best thing that I heard this week was in a conversation that I was having with a friend. And the statement came up in regards to, I did not understand the weight, W-E-I-G-H-T, of the weight, W-A-I-T.
The weight of the weight.
The weight of the weight.
Oh, wow. That's a quickie play on words there.
It is a really nice play on words. It is a very nice play on words. But the impact of, as we are walking through these seasons of adventure or these seasons of transformation, and how they don't happen quickly. And sometimes there's a heaviness in the midst of the weight as God is continuing to untangle the Christmas lights or untangle the very fine gold chain, that at times there's a lament of, I wish the weight would either go faster or wasn't as heavy. And there's just that, the weight of the weight. I don't know. I mean, it was perfectly said. I don't know how else to say it. So that was the best thing I heard this week.
Oh, pretty cool.
Yeah. What about you?
I think mine is the best thing I saw this week.
Ooh, okay.
And it goes back to the chaos of my yard. And
okay,
I'm sitting there we had some company this weekend. So we had people over, we had mm-hmm. stuff going on, and the yard just a disaster. And I've just said to Sarah, man, it's just so frustrating that I couldn't have gotten this done before the weekend, at least put it in some kind of presentable shape. We would have cleaned up a lot, or it would have been worse.
Yeah.
And Sarah said, doesn't bother me at all. What? She says, no, this is what has to happen before the garden begins. And the look of delight in her face. Yeah. Because I think I shared on a previous podcast, because two weeks ago, we were talking about where to put a light in a flower bed, and Sarah's sitting in front of it going, hey, that bush is there. There is no bush there. It's just dirt. And she's going, snowball bush is there. This is there. This is there. Light right here. I just look at her and I'm going, she sees the garden. She's not living with the disaster that's out here. She's already living with the garden, knows where things are going to go, knows what it's going to look like. And so when it's like, it's still a mess, she's just, hey, it's just part of what has to happen for the garden to grow. And I thought of so many scriptures, but I think of what God, in talking with Abraham and Sarah and their desire for a kid, God calls the things that are not as if they were, as a sense of what faith is. And I see that in Sarah. I see her being able to look at chaos that you think would frustrate her. We've been in this house now 2.5 months. You think she would love to have a garden she could work in right now? She's not worried a bit. She already sees that garden. So it doesn't matter that I don't and no one else does. She is not frustrated by anything going on out there. She's just like, it's just part of the process. And was it Sarayu in the shack just said, it's a mess, but it's a beautiful mess, perfectly in process. And Sarah was the embodiment of that this whole weekend. And I love the look in her eye when she could tell she's got plants over there, here. She sees it. She sees it all. And it's chaos. It's a total mess out there, but not in Sarah's heart. And if we could live that way, I think the weight of the weight would change.
It really would.
If we could see what already is in God's heart, what will be in our reality, and if faith is the substance of things hoped for. So it's not, we don't have the substance yet. We don't have the reality, but we have the hope of the reality. And that's living our life with faith, not the contrived stuff we've kind of learned in the past, but simply being able to see what God sees, even when our human eyes can't see it yet.
That really makes me think of the conversation between Elisha and Elijah when there's the prayer of open his eyes, and they and his eyes are open, and he's like, I had no idea this reality was around me. And yet to be able to live in that peace and that perspective of I'm already living in the garden, but nobody else can see it yet. But literally dwelling, her heart is already dwelling in the garden that is in the process of construction. And so the mess is okay. The process is okay. The destruction of things that previously were is okay because she's already living in the garden. Man, that would be a wonderful way to live life.
And yet that seems to be what living by faith is. Hmm. Not living by faith isn't, I'm trying to get God to do what I think he should do in my time frame, which is how we mostly want to live it. But it's, I'm letting God do in God's time frame, and I'm already enjoying the fruit of what I can't see yet. That's what Sarah's doing. She's already enjoying the fruit of a garden that isn't here yet. But it is here in her heart and mind. It's already her reality. And that sets her at ease with the chaos in her yard. And I do think there's much I could learn from this.
Man, that's powerful.
So I'm reading from the book of Sarah this week and learning what I need to learn about life and God's garden and God's creative process. And hey, when you got to do some revamping because some drains are plugged and you got to do some revamping, it's just all part of it.
You got to bring in the big drill sometimes.
You do. And so they're fixing to. Man, I see it happening out there. So I wish I had shades on my window so I could climb. There's no shades on my window yet. So I'm a victim of whatever goes on outside at the moment.
But you also are going to be able to live in a beautiful reality from your window too.
For sure. Hey, help me with this. I've got a good friend, been a good friend a long time. He had a Facebook post yesterday or day before. And the picture, it's a picture I hadn't seen before. It's a picture of, it's supposedly a day or two ago, some Georgian Orthodox priests. And this is the country of Georgia, not the state of Georgia, in Eastern Europe. And a whole line of priests are across a street, absolutely blocking the street. And there's hundreds, if not thousands of people. I don't know how far back it goes, but to the camera's eye, it was filled with people. Okay. And they were there to block a gay pride parade. That's why they were there. Mm-hmm. And what my friend wrote on his thing was, together with the Georgian Orthodox Church, together with the faithful people, stood up and blocked the LGBT procession and did not allow desecration on the streets. How my friend commented on that, when will we have the courage that these Orthodox priests have in Georgia? I wish I could leave well enough alone, but I generally don't. So I posted a comment that said, I don't think I share their resolve here and wonder if Jesus would stand in this line. Seems more a contest of power than it does a demonstrator of the Creator's love for his children, even the lost ones. What message does this send to those who support the LGBTQAI concerns? And would that reflect the gospel? And then I got lambasted. Because it's a group of friends that are just kind of all in that. And a lot of it was, well, they need to know the truth before they can know love. And I didn't engage it. Because once it becomes a soup of nobody listening to each other, I tend to back out.
Yeah.
But my thought was, do they not already know what you believe? Is you being on a street blocking their free expression of having a parade, making quote unquote a stand for morality, is that giving them information they don't have? So I don't know what you think of that. I honestly just go, wow, that's the presentation of the gospel that makes my heart hurt. Because it doesn't say you're loved. It says you don't count. And to think that any human lost, broken that they might be, is a desecration of our streets. Boy, I grew up in church with this guy who posted it. So, I mean, I've known this guy all my whole life, but we've gone down different roads for sure. And we're still good friends. He's not an ultra legalist. He's really thinks he's on a Jesus journey, and he is in some ways. I don't doubt that he is, but man. I am not on that page where I would go stand on a street and block somebody else's freedom in the name of making a stand for God. What about you? Do you join that line?
Honestly, I don't know if I could. I was in, maybe you and I talked about this in the past, but I got into a conversation probably about a month ago with a fellow individual that's practicing in mental health and found out that we were from similar backgrounds. And we got into the dialogue about the LGBTQ community. And this individual asked me, so how do you navigate that with people that would view the LGBTQ community as a, in some regards, an abomination to humanity, or, you know, one of the darkest expressions of the twisted humanity, or however they would want to identify it or put language around it. And for me, it's hard for me to even engage in the conversation until basically what I said to this individual is the way that I usually respond to those types of conversations is, do you have somebody in your community that you deeply love, that is a part of your life, that is connected to you in a very intimate way, that is a part of the LGBTQ community, whether it be a friend or a family member or whatever? Because if you do, and you have close connection and close relationship with that individual, and you're still genuinely questioning, I would love to have that conversation with you. But until it moves from an us versus them or a those people type conversation, it's hard to even have a conversation because there isn't the personhood of it. There's a dehumanizing that often comes from it. And largely it's prompted by fear of the unknown, fear of disconnection.
Fear of my world being disrupted by people I don't like. And we could say, I love them, I just don't like what they do. But the fact is the message comes across as you don't count in the same way we do. Our rights are more important than yours. And that stand for morality to me is old and tiresome. It's not like they don't have that message, but they don't know. I think of a quote that I heard a long time ago about, they understand their sin. It's grace they don't understand. And how do we unpack grace to a world that really feels like this is what I feel, this is what I identify with. I feel like I was created this way or made this way, and I'm having the expression of my true self or whatever. And you may disagree with them, but do you want them cutting off your free expression of what you think God is making you to be? That's where I see this going. You've got to be able at some point to say, hey, I may not agree with where your conscience is set, but I'll defend your right to have it because I want my freedom to hold my conscience. Mm-hmm. And if I'm saying, no, but I'm right and you're wrong, so I get mine and you don't get yours, we get to create a society that seeks to punish you in God's name. And then I think of, you know, Paul talking about himself being the chiefest of sinners. Why? Because he was part of the LGBTQAI community? No, because he was a Pharisee. Yeah. And so his idea of it was what religious arrogance and the attempt to force your point of view, which Paul was doing at the point of a spear, not necessarily blocking a parade route on the street.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, he became, what he said, the chiefest of sinners out of that religious arrogance. And it wasn't that Paul was wrong in the revelation of God he had. He wasn't wrong about that. Killing people would have been wrong about that. But, you know, he thought he needed this and people were going astray. And there's lots of Old Testament language about, you know, killing the heretic or the rebellious one among you. And so he launches off in a crusade like that and becomes the chiefest of sinners, not because of sexual sin, but because of religious arrogance. And I don't think people that I grew up with wrestle with that enough. We don't see our religious arrogance. You want to marginalize someone else for their failure or sin, but are you being honest about your own? Are you being honest about your own struggle? And I don't think that that's true because we tick off the morality boxes that are almost all sexual in our world. And then we feel like, oh, I qualify. I'm good. So God's pleased with me and these other people. I need to work against them in some way. And it's sad.
And I think the hard part with the conversation is coming back to a conversation you and I have had quite a bit, is the loudest voices in either community tend to be the most extreme, whether it be a polarization or a reaction to one or the other. And unfortunately, that hard part is that rarely defines the actual conversation or even embodies most of the people that are in the dialogue. I mean, that's true. One of my dearest friends is a part of the LGBTQ community. And my gosh, like, he is absolutely brilliant. I love the conversations that he and I get to have together all the time. And yet for him, that's a small part of who he is, but that's not the primary form of identification that he chooses. And that's okay. But even he has had to take some intentional steps back from some of his associations with that community, because from his words, it's moved from a community of individuals to a forced expression of pain. And for him, he doesn't want to take part in that. And this is somebody who's very active, who used to be a strong advocate for LGBTQ community rights. And it's not that he isn't advocating for rights, but it's the extreme movement one way or the other, where there's an intention to do good. There's an intention to bring more equality or more to express more humanity to a group of people or an individual that might have been marginalized in the past. But unfortunately, often pain and fear get in that either on either side of the argument, and it tends to really catalyze into something that it never was intended to be.
And that's where I find most people are at with this. Even people I know in the LGBTQI community, there's the militants that are trying to ram it down people's throats. And there's people who recognize that rational people may have some concern with their lifestyle or portrayal. And they're trying to be respectful of people who see it differently. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the people on both sides that advance the conversation. And when you lose respect for someone, this I got from a friend just as part of a larger email. He just wrote, "Preachers preach, writers write, godly men pontificate, theologians theologize, songwriters sing," and on and on it goes. "A still small voice gets butchered in light of a great need, bulldozing over incredible hurts and desires." People are told they have to own this or that version, when really they just need permission to own what their heart is already pulling them toward. The sheep get really tired of the Australian border collies barking and bullying them, and the native guiding them through their versions of religion, politics, or cultural norms. And to me, that the picture just says bully. We're going to meet power with power, not we're going to meet power with love. And by impeding someone else's parade, it comes off as bullying. And it's not just bullying. Bullying isn't excused just because you're right. Or just because you may have the right point of view on something. It doesn't give you the right to bully someone else, because both sides feel like they have the right view of things and the other side has the wrong view of things. And that's where society degenerates.
Another really, I think, intriguing and challenging conversation for the evangelical community is a lot of the teens that I work with that are exploring the LGBTQ community and exploring an alternative sexual identity. A lot of them are drawn to the LGBTQ community because they have branded themselves and have lived out a stance of, no matter who you choose to be or how you choose to live your life, we will love you and we will connect with you and we will accept you for who you are. That's a very interesting space that a lot of my teens are drawn to, because they experience love, they experience community, they experience connection, and where unfortunately a very high percentage of the people that I talk to that are really struggling with sexual orientation, they tend to come from conservative evangelical communities, and largely their deepest fear is, how are the people that I'm related to, how is my immediate community, my family, going to connect with me if I step outside of the box at all from what they've projected of this is what life is supposed to look like? And so, individuals that have no problem being open about who they are in front of peers or even in front of teachers, but are absolutely trembling in fear about what would happen if a family member was to find out, or how would that be received, or the level of rejection that is possible. And for me, that has been very challenging as I've listened to these young people's stories and thought, Lord, how would I receive their heart? How would I hold space for them? Especially if one of my daughters was navigating a similar conversation, would I still come at it with the same level of grace and compassion that I try to hold for my clients? I would hope I would.
Yeah. And it's difficult that on the side of when you've got to defend a morality, you can't be loving and accepting of people where they are in their journey. Even if, like, this was this thing I just read is about, there's a still small voice in all of us.
Yeah.
Challenging us to live in God's reality.
Yeah.
And to think that sometimes it gets drowned out by religious bullying is something that I don't think the evangelical community has wrestled with. To be accepting and loving of somebody whose conscience is set at a different place than your own is not complicated, unless you've got to fight a moral stand for the good of a nation or for whatever. It's not easy. It's not difficult to love people who are different than you if you're not bringing some moral stand to be the more important thing. And I do think inherent in the new covenant is that relationship with God became more important than your sinful brokenness. That the only way out of wherever we got stuck, whether it's religious arrogance or sexual sin or lying or on greed or whatever we could put into that quiver full of problems, is learning to yield to be loved by that voice of God's Spirit that dwells in you and invites you to life and will cause you to challenge the things that you think are good for you, that you find out, they're not so good for me. But when bullies try to do it for you, I mean, I we've been talking a little bit. Those of you who have seen Bright, Shiny People will know what that means. That's the Bill Gothard.
The Shiny Happy People.
Oh, is that what it is? So I said Bright, Shiny,
Shiny Happy People.
Shiny Happy People. Yeah, it's a documentary on Prime, I think. Amazon Prime. And interesting, because I came at it through, there was a documentary on the Hillsong explosion in New York, which also went back to the explosion in Sydney at the Mother Church, with some hiding, some moral, some predatory behavior by the father, the senior pastor. And then this whole situation in New York that blew up a church of thousands of people down to 500 just trying to exist now that some immorality was exposed. And then the happy, shiny people, and they all seem to have the roots in the same thing, this legalistic, manipulative kind of Christianity that allows the leaders to live to great excess and exclusion. Those rules don't apply to me. At the same time, I'm forcing them on other people.
Yeah.
And the pattern is so, I mean, I would think by this day, and I guess I'm so naive, we've had 40 years, 50 years of this thing being exposed. Some charismatic personality gets a group to follow him. It also involves a lot of rules and being zealous for Jesus. Because I also listened to a podcast about Last Days Ministries, which is Keith Green thing that became very cultic. Again, people living together, lots of rules about dating, ends up being quasi-arranged marriages in which people are not even happy to be together. Well, it's obviously very patriarchal. Husband is the head of the home. Wife shuts up and goes along. These things keep existing. And somewhere along the line, you would hope there'd be a growing sensitivity in Jesus to say, we've been down this road 100 times. The flashy guy on the stage, you know nothing about him. He's making money. He's exploiting you for the kingdom of God, as he would say it, right? Or she would say it. And yet all you're doing is getting a lot of people to do a lot of free work to build your kingdom. And that was Last Days Ministries, whether it's 15-year-old stuffing envelopes or whatever. They had nearly slave labor so that the famous singer at the time, Keith Green, could go around and give albums away and be generous. But back home, there's a whole bunch of people being exploited for that to happen, not only exploited for their labor, but when you're 18, 19, 20, and you're looking at some powerful leader and you get sucked into, man, I want to be zealous for Jesus like that. Mm-hmm. And then you're told how to live your life and you do it. And you realize 10 years later, this was a ladder up the wrong wall. And I got up there without a sensitivity to Jesus, without following him. And I spent the best years of my life or something that I thought was wonderfully godly, and turned out it wasn't. It wasn't any of that. And instead of exhorting me, encouraging me to greater life, it actually exploited me in a way that now makes me embittered. And how many people come out of these things atheists instead of God followers?
Well, and on top of that, what a brilliant scheme of the enemy, because it makes you start to hate passion, to hate zeal, to hate drive, because then all of a sudden you see the potential negative impact of that and how deeply scarring it could be. And then we, it's like, okay, well, then we just need to kill passion. We need to get rid of our emotions. We need to live a contemplative life, or, you know, what, I mean, and there's, it's so reactionary.
It is.
And it tends to swing to from one end of the spectrum to the other. And I just, especially, I mean, with all the exposure that's come over, even just within the last 5 years, Hillsong, Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. I mean, all of these conversations coming up about
the Liberty University Jerry Falwell thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's like, okay, if this is the brand of Christianity, if this is the monumental expression of the life of Christ in the world, then now what do we do? Was it Martin Luther that said the greatest cause of atheism is believers that acknowledge him with their lips and then go out into the world and do whatever the heck they want to do? I can't remember the exact quote, but basically, like, actually a DC Talks, it was like, that's what an unbelieving world finds so unbelievable. Is it, like, I remember that quote because it was at the beginning of this song, and that has stuck with me. I mean, that was back in the early 90s when that came out. And yet it's like, man, that I connect with that night. I resonate with that so deeply, especially as Jess and I have a lot of conversations, because she didn't come from an evangelical Christian background at all, like mm-hmm. had no Christianity background. I mean, she was a very young believer when she and I first met and got married. And so she comes from just a different perspective on the way that people connect in community and Jesus, and what does that look like? And my heart breaks when I look at the lens, and yet the question is, so then what do we do? Right? Like, do we just succumb? Do we just sit down? Do we step off? Do we disengage from the fight? Do we step into the background? Do we silence our voice? What do we do? What would you say to somebody that is looking at this and looking at all the corruption in the institution of Christianity and say, well, what do we do then? The brand is corrupted. The image of Jesus is corrupt. What do we do? What do we do with this? How do we live this out in the world?
I think we need to live a different journey. And I think many people have, but they don't get the visibility. When you draw people into an expensive, big operation at a time when they either work for free or raise their own support, then the organization or the leader doing that to them is exploiting something for himself. And we always want to believe it's for the good of the kingdom, particularly when these appeals are made to very young kids who are fresh out of high school and they want their lives to count for something, for Jesus.
Yes, absolutely.
And then the lures are all there. It's come work with me, and it's be close to somebody that you admire, a singer or a speaker or whatever. And then you come alongside that, and then a community kind of gives birth to us, people volunteering to come help work. And then it's start internship programs. So you're pushing to the reward is they'll get you an internship, and that may lead to a staff job someday. And then you can actually get paid for the hundreds of hours. When I heard the number of hours used every week to put together that service for Hillsong in New York, I just, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. And then to see the entitlement that comes on top of that, always at the top. When I was with Hillsong, some former elders at Hillsong probably 10 years ago in Sydney, and the stories they told me of opulence, of how the whole thing was created. And you go, okay, there's got to be a man behind this of extremely low character to do what he's doing to people. Have a green room that you got to throw the food away at the end of the day because it's so expensive. You don't want people in the congregation finding out that you have that kind of airport lounge is the green room for this congregation. Oh, yeah. Or that Hillsong began as a music concert thing of a lot of churches combined. And then someone, because of the branding was so huge, someone built a church off of it and sucked people in from all over the place. When you see that lack of character in what people are doing, I wouldn't get too upset about it. I mean, we can talk about it because I want people to be aware. Just because somebody exploited you in God's name is not God exploiting you. Lewis and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about, he said, I told you about my Beethoven dream, right? And I said, Beethoven dream? I don't think so. He said, yeah. I said, I was talking to Jesus in a dream. He often sits on a park bench and talks to Jesus. And this one, Jesus asked him, he said, do you know who Beethoven is? And I mean, Lewis doesn't have a lot of classical music background. So he said, well, he wrote some songs, right? And, yeah, he wrote some songs. And he had a, there's some big party that Jesus threw for Beethoven and said, man, this, I gave my gifts to this man. And he used it to uplift the hearts of people with the gift of song that I put in his heart. And so then at this big party for him to celebrate that. And then the music, Beethoven's music started to play with some orchestra or something. And it was horrible, out of sync, off key. It was a horrible version. And the people began to get angry who were at the party, and they began to boo Beethoven and throw tomatoes and bananas and stuff at Beethoven because he wrote such horrible music. And Lewis was watching all this in a dream, and Jesus just turned to him and says, hey, just because they don't play it well is no reflection on Beethoven, right? And I think what Lewis got out of that was, man, yes, there's lots of people take my stuff and exploit it for their own gain, hurt a lot of people. But you know what? It doesn't reflect on me. Jesus or God, they don't seem all that defensively angry about all the way they get abused in the world, all the way their name is taken in vain, all the way that they... their stuff is used to exploit people. Because I think maybe the still small voice is still in those people saying, come away from this. And they, because of what they get out of it, they keep getting deeper, 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 deeper. And then it finally crashes. And that's still part of their story. It's part of, did I find a God bigger than the failures of my religious leaders? And I did. I have found religious leaders to have feet of clay. But you know what? I have found a God that's bigger than the failures of anybody else. And we're all flawed. We can all make stupid mistakes. But the ones that really bother me, I mean, the Bill Gothard thing and the child-rearing thing, when he was being so exploitive of children and women, and all this comes out later. It never comes out while they're at the pinnacle of power.
Yeah.
But if you couldn't hear in their teaching something off-key from the Father, then you don't get to blame them. You don't. You missed the voice. You knew better. And I talked to a lot of people. Go back. They weren't there? Yeah, there were. And you tried to, and everybody just kind of pumps you back up. And yeah, but it's feeding you something. It gives you identity. It gives you belonging. It gives you some sense of significance because you're doing something great for God. And I think that's part of what we have to wrestle with too. One, let's not do that. Those of us who are following Jesus, don't build kingdoms to yourself in the name of God. And two, don't blame someone else if you got sucked into that. Find the God who's real. Because I can tell you, there's surely a God who is real. And just because someone else plays him badly is not a reflection on that God.
I think that's such a hard thing, though, because I know, especially even myself as a young person, I mean, that's part of my story. I was doing some international missions work, heard about this pastoral internship at a megachurch that I was impressed with in California. And that's what brought me out to California. That was what created the opportunity for you and I to meet. That's what created the opportunity for my wife and I to meet. And yet, oh my gosh, I mean, some of the things that happen behind closed doors, there was the green room. You know, the pastor would drive up in his Porsche and he would park in a handicapped spot and he'd be rushed into his green room by aspiring models and have his chai latte exactly the way that he wanted it or whatever coffee he had. And he would sit there and be pampered and get do makeup and the whole thing. And then as soon as it was done, he'd get whisked out. And it's so interesting because that wasn't the way that it began. Even that, and getting a look behind the scenes in that and seeing the just, the opulence and the corruption and the twistedness. I mean, literally having one of my good friends who spent 2 years dedicating all of his time working full time and has a conversation with the upper leadership and says, hey, I would love to be able to continue here full time, we need to be able to pay for it, you know, whatever. Love to come on as a staff position. And like, no, you're a white male. We have too many white males on staff. And so unless you're a person of diversity or a minority, we're not going to hire you. You can continue to volunteer as an intern like you have been for the last 2.5 years full time. But no, we're never going to pay you. And you're never going to get a position here. And yet there's this deep, deep heart longing, I think, that is written in the hearts of all humanity that says, I want to be a part of something more and greater than myself. I want to be a part of something that leaves a positive impact in the world, that engages people's hearts in a meaningful way. I want to do something like that. And that, I know you put that longing in people's hearts, and yet it can be so easily derailed or or focused or shot off in a direction that often is not becoming to what the kingdom is. And yet, even in the weeds, that's where I got the book, So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore. That's where I met my wife. That's where I started encountering conversation that went deeper than the institution that was bearing his name.
Yeah, and why though? It wasn't just the longing. God gives us a longing to be part of something bigger than ourselves. And I hate when that gets crushed by these kinds of things.
Yeah.
On the other hand, he also gave us a yuck meter.
Oh, well, yes.
Because your yuck meter went off. You didn't find So You Don't Want to Church Anymore because they gave it out in the internship program at that fellowship, right?
No.
And I wasn't teaching intern classes there. So when you say we met because of that, no, we met because the yuck meter went off and you were asking questions. And those questions led you to different resources and different relationships. And I think that's what I want to say to people. You got to trust your yuck meter. When something doesn't seem right to you, it probably isn't. And when somebody says, listen, we know God better than you do, so you need to shut up and follow what we're telling you, you need to know that's not a man of or woman of God speaking to you at that point, because they're going to want you to follow Jesus as he makes himself known to you, even if you're getting that wrong a bit. I'd rather you follow a voice, and I don't mean a voice like out of the woodwork or anything. I just mean that internal nudge. I'd rather you follow that nudge, even if you make a mistake now and then somehow contain you with a fence that won't allow you to make a mistake, but to no longer follow either.
Yeah.
Now you're just going out of human wisdom. And unfortunately, it's not even your own human wisdom. You've sold your conscience to someone else who's willing. And this is what's so sad to me, because I think whether it's Hillsong or Youth with a Mission or Last Days, like you said, almost always these things begin very genuine. Mm-hmm. And then it begins to pick up a human momentum that then has to be controlled and contained and manipulated. And I think at the end of it, nobody really wanted it to get there, including those who led it.
Yeah.
But they couldn't say no to the enticements of their heart. And they couldn't say yes to their yuck meter. They couldn't go, dude, this is yucky. Good. So stop doing it. Find another way to take your passion into the world without yucking up the lives of other people. And as one person said recently, you take kids and Youth with a Mission has done that. You take kids right at their formative years, right, getting out of high school. And if you went and did a year with Youth with a Mission, gap year, great, come back, get a degree, get a job. But these kids, some of them take 10, 12, 15 years, they're getting their friends to pay for it. Then they realize this isn't working for me. And one of the things that always bugged me with ministry stuff, things I've worked with, is why don't you guys provide a debrief? So when people are going back to the real world, they're ready. Because growing up in a bus on a bunch of mission bases with people to talk Jesus all day long, that's one thing. You go back to real life where that support structure isn't there. A lot of them flounder, even if they thought the experience was positive. Why don't you provide a debrief for them? And almost every ministry said, yeah, we really need to do that, blah, blah. They never do. And I think the problem is because they really don't want those kids to thrive when they go home. They want them to miss what they were a part of and maybe come back and do it again and do more because we've got lots to do for Jesus in the world. And it's not, I really care about you becoming a wholehearted, successful person in the world. I'm really driven by this ministry and what we hope to do and how we can use you to get there in and all with the blinders of this is God doing this.
Yeah.
And then people have to shut down that still small voice to a barking border collie that's saying, no, do we want? And most people are insecure enough that it's difficult for them to follow the voice that God wants them to follow, because who am I? Who am I to say I know better than that guy or that girl who's making a big splash in the Christian media world?
I mean, having done YWAM, having served as a discipleship training school leader, that was one of the biggest things that I wanted to encourage. So thankfully, both YWAM experiences that I had, there actually was a reentry process.
Oh, wow.
At the end of the experience. And I think that was partially because the two people that were kind of leading the thing or working with a lot of the students had left and had to sort through the pain of that and working through that. And what does it look like to re-engage with the world in a way that isn't just this Christianese bubble language, type thing. And they'd seen the value of that. And yet, you know, a lot of the people that I talk to in a lot of them, those types of ministry experiences, they even themselves don't know how to do the reentry process. And so for them to teach somebody how to do reentry when they haven't gone and done reentry themselves is a really hard process to do that. And you're absolutely right. You know, that was, there were so many people. I'm still in contact with quite a few people from my original discipleship training school. The vast majority of them have very little to do with the evangelical world anymore. Some of them still have gone on and have very deep faiths that are very much a part of their lives, but a lot of them have not. And it's really intriguing to see, and it's very heartbreaking to see that process.
Yeah, and I know many who have just given up on God when they found out their religious leader wasn't who they thought he or she was. And I think a lot of people listen to this podcast are people who are saying, you know what, I found a God more real than the failures of my leadership. And that's a good thing, because Jesus came to be the shepherd of us all. You won't need shepherds. I will be your shepherd, and I will lead you into safe pasture, and you'll never need to be afraid again.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.